the Trump administration's latest move to end Obamacare, and Kai Rizdahl guides us through the latest Brexit drama. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl while he's on assignment in the U.K. It's Tuesday, March 26th. Good to have you with us. The White House is trying to strike another blow to Obamacare. In a filing with the federal appeals court yesterday, the Trump administration said the entire Affordable Care Act should be struck down. Previously, it had called for only parts of the law to go. So the change in strategy is a big one. And if the White House eventually prevails, the economic consequences will be huge. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
The Affordable Care Act just had its ninth birthday a few days ago. Linda Blumberg with the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute says it's hard to calculate all the implications of taking it away.
The Affordable Care Act has so many pieces that it really has reached in to almost every area of the healthcare system.
She says getting rid of the ACA would mean reversing Medicaid expansions, no more letting young adults stay on their parents' health plans, an end to prescription drug cost sharing for seniors, and lots more.
We estimate that the increase in the number of people uninsured in the country would be about 20 million people.
Now, ironically enough, if that happens, it could conceivably increase support for single-payer alternatives, most of which are being called Medicare for All.
Martin Gaynor is a professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon.
Once people have something, they're very reluctant to give it up. It's hard to take away.
But nothing's changing yet, and maybe won't change at all. Abby Gluck directs the Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School. She questions whether the appeals court will uphold the lower court's decision that the whole ACA must go. And she says even if the appeals court agrees, the case would then likely go to the Supreme Court.
So there would be no immediate effects, although the insurance markets would be further destabilized by the uncertainty.
This afternoon, Democrats unveiled plans to move in the opposite direction, building on the ACA. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Okay, now let's talk Brexit. It's been a day of swings and roundabouts for British Prime Minister Theresa May as she tries to steer Great Britain out of the European Union. The party that's been propping up her government said they would no longer support her deal. Meanwhile, the leaders of her opposition say they may have no choice but to accept it. Marketplace host Kai Rizdahl is in London this week talking to different people about these uncertain times and what all this means for the British economy. Kai, good to have you on.
Hey, Kimberly, how are you?
I'm all right. Where'd we catch up with you?
I am standing actually in Parliament Square, right outside the Houses of Parliament. Westminster Abbey's around the corner. Came down, number one, to make a point, and number two, to give you a little bit of a scene. There are some protests going on here, but the point to be made is that these people are just tired, and the protesters are looking a little lackluster. They're just standing there waving their EU flags or their Brexit no deal right now flags. People here are, well, they're tired of this whole story. I got to tell you that.
And I have to imagine the folks in Parliament are tired of it too. Action last night, supposedly more votes coming tomorrow. What's happening there?
Oh, yeah, way more votes coming tomorrow. So first of all, let's be clear. This is a political story, but we're going to cover the economics of it because no matter when Brexit happens, and frankly, that's in some doubt now, the economics of it, the economic impact, the business impact of it has already started and is already happening. Just to the politics of it for a second, though, Theresa May is in some political jeopardy here. There are votes happening tomorrow. The Parliament is going to decide maybe what it wants to do. And then probably on the 12th of April, but maybe on the 22nd of May, who knows, the UK is scheduled now to leave the European Union if, you know, nothing changes in the next 48 to 72 hours, which is a gamble.
Right, because things seem to always change with Brexit. But speaking of those changes, we expected that deadline to be this Friday, which is why you're there right now. So why are you still there right now?
Well, we're here because, as I said, the economic story has already started. You know, we've been out talking to people for, what, 3 or 4 days now. Here are just two snapshots. We went out yesterday and talked to a guy. He's an Italian gentleman working here for 15 years, runs a fashion company. He imports fabrics and designs and materials from all over the European Union. And he says he spends 25% of his time dealing with Brexit and the ramifications for his business. Talked to another guy at a pub last night. who's in the food importing and exporting business, right? He says 80% of his time for the past year has been spent dealing with Brexit. And so when you think about not only the government concentrating on Brexit so much, but businesses concentrating on Brexit, that's real impact when these folks are having to do this at the same time as they're trying to run their business.
Right, it must be exhausting, but at the same time, like, what other vibe are you getting out there? I mean, if there are protesters, I'm guessing there's some anger, too.
There is some anger. I think more than anger, really, there's frustration, right? There's great political frustration. There's great, as I said, economic frustration. And then you look at the people who voted to leave, right? And who knows when or if it's going to happen. One of the things we did Saturday when we got here is we took a train up to Boston, England. We went to Boston because that is the most pro-Brexit city in the UK. 75% of the people voted to leave. For them, it's a migration story more than anything else, right? The folks in Boston have seen an influx of mostly Eastern European immigrants, lots of folks from Poland and Lithuania, and the catch for them is this. They are a labor force, those folks are, and they have revitalized parts of Boston, which has fallen on some economic hard times. But also, the locals, the folks who have been there for a while, they're seeing crowding in hospitals, they're seeing crowding in their schools. And so while they want that economic gain that they get, the labor force that they get from these Eastern Europeans, they don't want the crowding that happens with extra people in their community.
Right. And so we are now looking out for those votes tomorrow.
Yes, the votes tomorrow in London. And, you know, arguably more importantly, this show on the air Wednesday through Friday from the BBC talking about Brexit, what it means, and the economic impacts that have already started to happen.
And Kai, you and the team are posting updates of your travels to Instagram, right?
We are. I'm doing a lot of Instagram videos. I'll tell you what. We are at Marketplace APM on Insta, so check us out.
All right. Thanks, Kai, and we'll look forward to hearing you from London tomorrow.
You bet. Talk to you soon, Kimberly. Thanks.
On Wall Street today, things are looking up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's news today. Drug maker Purdue Pharma and its owners, the Sackler family, will pay $270 million to settle a lawsuit brought by the Oklahoma Attorney General. The suit targets the company over its role in the deadly opioid epidemic and its aggressive marketing of opioid painkillers like OxyContin. Marketing has been a big part of our country's drug history, both for and against drugs. Think anti-drug public service announcements, or PSAs. That's one of the topics in the latest season of our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, which just came out. And while the government has spent over $1 billion on anti-drug PSAs since the 1980s, Marketplace's Peter Balanon Rosen reports those ads may be memorable for the wrong reason.
If the idea of anti-drug PSAs brings to mind an image of an egg in a frying pan, you're not alone. This 1987 ad from Partnership for a Drug-Free America is a bit of a poster child.
This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
That became sort of iconic, but I know that it's also been widely parodied.
That's Michael Ludwig, professor of health education at Hofstra University. Starting with Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign, TV viewers in the 80s were blitzed with anti-drug PSAs, like McGruff the Crime Dog and A Chorus of Children singing that drug users are losers. Okay, kinda laughable today. These types of ads, though, they didn't work. In fact, some ads had a forbidden fruit effect. They made teens even more curious.
When you advertise against it, you may also be inadvertently advertising for it.
Ludwig says these PSAs also broadcast cultural messages about who uses and sells drugs.
I saw there was one where there was a young black male who was suggesting, hey, kids, get your mom and dad out of the room.
Hey, little dude, send your mom and daddy out of the room. I gotta get you up on this.
As he talks about the various drugs that he had for sale, he morphs from a young black man into literally a snake.
Now, some folks will tell you that I'm dealing in poison, but hey, do I look like the kind of guy that would do that to a kid like you?
Charlton McElwain is an associate professor at New York University who specializes in race and media.
I'm getting a message of fear, but what I'm seeing is an image of blackness.
He says that's not just offensive, that's harmful. And
in subtle ways gives us license to treat people like animals. And that's precisely what you saw throughout the crack war, looking at African Americans primarily as its target.
Money spent in the 80s on those ads was a waste.
That's Keith Humphreys, a former drug policy advisor to Presidents Bush and Obama. Those ads, he says, were basically lectures saying,
you shouldn't use drugs because authority figures have told you not to. Now be a good boy or a good girl and do what you're told. No adolescent wants to hear that.
So anti-drug messaging in the 90s and 2000s got scarier, more graphic, saying, fine, if you do abuse drugs, here are the dire consequences. Today, Arizona is spending $400,000 on an anti-opioid social media campaign. It has two horror movie-themed ads with teens trapped inside a pill.
Opioids. Getting in is easier than getting out.
Sheila Scholander, assistant director at the Arizona Department of Health Services, says incarcerated teens helped design the ads.
It's those scarier messages that show those graphic consequences.
But here's the thing. In 2016, the federal government evaluated different research into anti-alcohol, tobacco, and drug messaging, and found fear tactics pretty ineffective. Going full-blown scary might work on teens already unlikely to use, but for others, it leads them to tune out. Today, there's a reason we don't see too many national anti-drug PSAs. The media budget for the government office funding those ads was axed in 2012 after years of criticism its ads were ineffective, which leaves nonprofits and states to take up the PSA helm. Again, here's Keith Humphreys, who says some states are reaching for a different playbook.
Just give people factual bits of information that are helpful to them.
Like what to do if you're struggling with addiction or tips on preventing overdoses. Because teens are teens, and once you start telling them what to do, that's when they start tuning out. I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen for Marketplace.
The Uncertain Hours third season is out now, so please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. McDonald's is making a $300 million bet on artificial intelligence. That's how much it paid for AI company Dynamic Yield, which already works with IKEA, Sephora, and Urban Outfitters. This is McDonald's largest acquisition since it bought Boston Market 20 years ago. As to what a fast food restaurant needs with AI, it's all about the drive-thru, which, as Marketplace's Renata Sego reports, accounts for more than 70% of McDonald's business.
Pull into the line at a typical McDonald's drive-thru, and you're greeted by a screen showcasing some specials. Pull forward, and you'll see the standard menu for that time of day. Then you hear a voice.
Morning, am I helping you?
Yeah, I'd like a cheeseburger and a Coke.
Cheeseburger and a Coke, okay. Anything else?
McDonald's wants to be able to anticipate the answer to that last question and put the right information on those screens. Dynamic Yield will help the chain upgrade its drive-thru menu so that they change based on factors like the weather and the time of day. Michael Littman teaches computer science at Brown University. He says the menus will highlight timely and relevant items for customers.
Increasing the amount that we're buying at checkout.
And when you serve billions and billions of burgers, AI can give you a pretty good idea of what customers might want. Littman says it'll help McDonald's answer questions like,
if we offered them a Sunday at this moment, would they go for it?
The capabilities won't stop at the drive-thru, says Eric Cohen of Cambridge Consultants. He expects that McDonald's will use what it learns for its mobile app and loyalty program.
The systems could become smart enough such that they could say, I'm sorry you've had too many hamburgers this week, I suggest a salad.
There are risks for McDonald's. RJ Hadavi of Morningstar Research says one of the chain's recent success stories has been simplifying its operations.
Improving the service speed and the order accuracy. And by adding this technology, you may add some complexity back into the model.
McDonald's hopes to roll out Dynamic Yield's technology in drive-thrus at its more than 14,000 U.S. locations this year. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we spent all our allowance as kids, every penny of it, on baseball cards.
How two brothers turned a childhood hobby into a lucrative side hustle. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 0.5%, picking up 140 points to close at 25,657. The NASDAQ grew 0.7%, finding 53 points to finish at 76.91. And the S&P 500 added 0.7%, ticking up 20 points to close at 28.18. Renata Sego just told us about McDonald's acquisition of artificial intelligence company Dynamic Yield. McDonald's shares were up 0.9%. In Europe, Britain's FTSE added 0.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.42%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. Think about your favorite social media site. Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, whichever you prefer. You've probably checked it at work before. And when all of us do that, what does it mean for our overall productivity? Marketplace's Sabri Benishor reports.
Some people, definitely not me ever, but some people check social media at work.
Oh, God. A lot. Mostly Instagram.
It's definitely like 3-4 hours a day. It's not pretty.
Instagram, Facebook.
I just look at stuff.
These are all people we talk to in New York. They don't want their bosses to know how much time they spend on social media at work, obviously. So the question is all of this making us less productive than we would otherwise be?
And I think every time my boss turned her back, I was on my phone and not being productive and doing what I needed to do.
Because this is actually legit part of a burning question in economics. Why aren't we more productive? And I mean productive in the economic sense. How much do we produce per hour worked in the economy?
Well, the amazing fact is productivity growth has actually been falling over the last 50 years.
Nicholas Bloom is a professor of economics at Stanford. Productivity is growing, just at a slower and slower rate. So in the 1950s, annual productivity growth was near 4%. In the 90s, it was about 2%. Now it's about 1.3%.
It's particularly bad since the mid-2000s, so the last 10 to 15 years. And the reason this is such a surprise is we're surrounded by amazing new technology, but we just don't see it in the productivity numbers.
So literally, is part of this because we are on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube all day?
That's actually a surprisingly tricky question.
Eric Brynjolfsson is director of MIT's initiative on the digital economy. Tricky because it depends on whose productivity you mean. If you're talking about an individual's productivity, then actually, from an economist's perspective, being on social media may mean people are more productive.
It's good for them. They have a more pleasant job. They're spending more time consuming things. And if they're still delivering what they promised it to be delivering, then our economy is actually more productive than we thought.
Hear that? We are so productive that people can be on social media and still get their work done. But this kind of productivity doesn't show up in official economic calculations because social media is free, so it doesn't get measured no matter how much you might enjoy it. So maybe, Brynjolfsson says, the official productivity numbers would be higher if they took this into account. Still, that leaves the question of whether our companies' and businesses' productivity growth has been slowed because of social media distractions.
It doesn't look like it's the biggest problem with productivity.
Robbie McDonald is CEO of Rescue Time, a company that helps people be more productive at work.
What we see is on average, people spend about 18 minutes a day on social media. And if you add in 12 minutes a day on news, that's about a half hour.
Other estimates by economists say it could be higher, an hour. Either way, McDonald says companies don't really come to him as much as they used to, all worried that employees are on social media too much. The productivity drain that he sees is related but different. It's interruption from email, chat, even work-related stuff.
And if you divert yourself from a task, the amount of time that it takes to refocus on that task can be anywhere from about 6 to 20 minutes.
There's one last thing that makes this question of worker productivity and social media especially hard to figure out.
There has definitely been a trend over the past several years of more and more work leaving the office with people.
It's hard to figure out if productivity growth at work is slowing because we're taking work home with us.
The way that it's difficult during the day to switch off from your personal life, it's becoming just as difficult to switch off from your work life at home.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as I wake up, I'm looking at emails. And before I go to bed, I'm looking at emails.
Mickey Winter there is a tech worker in New York. So maybe we aren't doing more at work because we're doing it at home. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Thursday is opening day for Major League Baseball, go Cardinals. So now's as good a time as any to talk about baseball cards. Bo and Brian Abbott are brothers, and they love baseball cards. They're huge collectors, but not the seriously valuable, one-of-a-kind cards that might come to mind. The Abbott brothers have made a fairly lucrative side gig out of the cards most collectors might flip past. Here they are with the story of baseball card vandals.
We were huge, just baseball card nerds.
We spent all our allowance as kids, every penny of it, on baseball cards.
That's what our money went to.
What would our $5 allowance, how could we stretch that into as many Topps, Donruss, Score, Fleer, you know, as possible?
Put the good ones in plastics, and commons would just sort of fall in these boxes or shoe boxes or just so many of these cards.
They just made millions and millions of those cards. So our collections that we poured all our money into in the 80s and early 90s.
Absolutely worth nothing.
Worth nothing.
Luckily, we found something to do with them.
So Baseball Card Vandals is a website, social media thing where we draw on our old baseball cards and we post them online. It's all about being absurd, surprising, and just getting two laughs a day.
But what's the funniest card we've done?
I'm going to nominate one of Brian's, which is a classic called Putting Extra Coleslaw in a Container. First, it's a nonsense sentence. Secondly, it's a baseball player. He's like crouched. So Brian just put it like a plastic Tupperware container and, you know, some utensils and coleslaw. And he's like on the ground of the baseball field. He's messing around with coleslaw. His name is Alex Cole.
And we've done this all for absolutely no reason besides just trying to make each other laugh.
The first couple years of Baseball Card Vandals, we didn't even think of selling the cards because who would want to buy a card that was, you know, scribbled on?
One night, I think you were visiting and we just said, let's put this one online for sale. And that night, I remember somebody bought one.
We're trying to figure out what to sell it for, because it's not like there's an established market for old baseball cards drawn on with Sharpies.
I mean, if we would have put that for a dollar, that would have been a big-time sale.
Yeah, I mean, and it would have been a big mistake for us, because then we would have had to sell everything for a dollar. I think our first one was $25, and then somewhere along the way, we upped the price, the kind of base price, to $35, and then the ones we really love, we usually price for $50. Now we pretty much sell, I'd say, 90% of the ones we do.
Still love baseball cards to this day. I like the way they look. We like the way they feel in our hands. Just going through, like, a whole box of commons still brings us joy.
Now, at this point in our lives, we've gotten into collecting some older cards from the 50s and 60s. That are really cool and beautiful, and they're almost like pieces of art or antiques. We wouldn't mess with those. We stick to the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, overproduced.
The ones that we're comfortable with.
Yeah, we're comfortable with drawn all over them, and no one's going to miss them.
Brothers Bo and Brian Abbott of the website and book Baseball Card Vandals. You can see how the brothers make their cards on our YouTube channel. That's Marketplace APM. And while you're there, subscribe. And this final note on the way out, let's take it back to Europe, where the EU Parliament voted today to end seasonal time shifts. You know, moving clocks forward in the spring and back in the fall. One time, all the time, would kick in starting in 2021, but today's vote isn't the final word on the matter. EU member countries still have to pass their own laws to implement it, but hey, at this point, it's more of a sure thing than Brexit. We've got to go. Today, the Dow gained 0.5%, 140 points. The NASDAQ grew 0.7%, 53 points. And the S&P 500 added 0.7%, up 20 points on that index. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Siobhan Barrett, Barbara Platt, Brian Ronigan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Moody is the Executive Director of Digital. Sitara Nieves is our Executive Director of On-Demand. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Have a good evening. Kai will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.